WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. 10 years ago, writer Reynolds Price was walking with a colleague on the campus of Duke University, where Price taught, when his friend asked, "Why are you slapping your left foot on the pavement?" Price was unaware of his strange gait, but as weeks passed, he noticed some other puzzling symptoms, problems with his walking and his balance. He decided to go for some tests and was unprepared for what he heard. A large cancerous tumor was lodged on his spinal column. Price underwent 3 operations to remove the tumor and 5.5 weeks of radiation therapy, which sapped his energy and left him a paraplegic. A Whole New Life is Price's memoir of the 4 years following the discovery of the cancer, a period, he says, which changed him for the better. He's written 14 books in the last 10 years, including Kate Vaden, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1986. I spoke with Reynolds Price about his life after the diagnosis, and he told me what he wanted from his friends.
I think what was comforting, certainly in the early stages, was simple company. And rather quiet, calm company. No, I didn't want someone. I would have been driven mad by someone who was saying every 10 seconds, "Are you okay? May I get you a glass of lemonade? May I do this?" That would have driven me absolutely mad. I wanted someone to accompany me, perhaps in a kind of serene solitude, and to help me do things that already were getting very hard for me to do, like walking and going to the bathroom and taking showers. And by then, it was already very unsafe for me to cook for myself because it was very easy for me to fall and drop things and drop hot food on limbs that were already getting numb. So I wanted a kind of benign presence in my life that wasn't too insistent on itself or on my particular needs, and that by the most incredible luck and grace, a series of family members, kinsmen, and friends and former students of mine who were friends simply provided that care without a single let up.
Did you feel the need to hibernate or withdraw?
Yes, I did, and I did withdraw. A person who leads a very active life in the world and travels and sees friends and entertains and goes to entertainments. But for virtually the first year of this ordeal, I basically holed up in my house in the country outside Durham, North Carolina, and really very severely limited who I saw and how much time I spent with them.
Did you also limit your thoughts? Limit your imagination?
My imagination got limited because I was trying to finish a novel that I'd begun called Kate Vaden, and I'd written a third of it, and I very much wanted to get back to it. I knew that the best means of health and healing that I could manage would be to get back to work. But for 5 solid months, I was really in deep depression and basically sat in a chair, unable to read, unable to do anything except stare out the window and really just hope that I was going somehow to survive.
You write about the kind of treatment that you got by physicians and by nurses and by rehabilitation therapists and others. How did you want to be treated? Because you have some pretty harsh criticisms for mostly physicians and how they treated you.
My problems were all with physicians and almost specifically, invariably, with the more trained the physician, the more years of specialization the physician had, the less humane the physician tended to be. It was a very disturbing and depressing discovery to notice that as one proceeds downward in a hierarchy of skill in the world of medicine and healthcare, that the humanity tends to increase the further down the social ladder you go, so that the most humane people you encounter tend to be the practical nurses and the orderlies who are at the bottom of that social and financial ladder.
Do you think, and I'm wondering how specialists view the kind of condition that you had, that they see their work as failure if they can't fix the condition?
Oh, I think you've got it. I think that's one very large factor that I was dealing with at the time. I think, invisibly tattooed across my forehead, they saw the word dead. And they didn't somehow wish to ally themselves with a dead man. I must say that a great many other people who haven't been in nearly as dire a situation as I was tell me that they've had identical response from highly specialized doctors in the early stages of a traumatic illness. I find it very peculiar that we make those excuses for doctors. We say, oh goodness, they see so much suffering, they have to freeze over or at least callous over. But we don't make that excuse for caregivers of other sorts in our society. And many of us spend huge amounts of time in contact with unhappy people on a day-to-day basis. One of the most wonderful nurses that I had in my various stays in Duke Hospital in the early and mid-80s was a woman who came into me one night, and we were just talking very late at night, and she said that she had just finished working 8 years on the pediatric burn ward.
Oof.
Can you imagine what that must have been like?
Mm-mm.
And she was a person of immense warmth and generosity of heart.
One of the things I know you had to deal with was an extreme degree of pain. And I don't know if it's possible to describe the kind of pain that you had, but give it a shot.
Well, it's what the doctors in the pain clinic told me was called central pain. It's the intractable, to a large extent untreatable pain that results when some part of the central nervous system, the brain or the spinal cord itself, is severely damaged, severely traumatized. The only way I can ever explain it to people is by saying that along the whole length of my spinal cord, on a perfectly normal day, I will simply feel as though someone has laid down a layer of some extremely flammable substance and lit a match, and that my spine is constantly burning and on fire.
Even right now as we speak?
Even as we speak. And then my legs... If you can imagine your leg waking up from that awful sense of going to sleep and all the prickles and spiny feelings up and down your legs, multiply that by about maybe 20, and you then begin to imagine the kind of sensations that I have in my legs. Those forms of pain are, of course, you know, the famous phantom pain, because basically there's no longer any connection between the lower extremities of my body and my brain. But like the veteran who lost his toe at Iwo Jima, but it still itches, you know, when he's in bed at night. My brain is still very alarmed about its missing connections.
Well, you talk about 3 years of your narcotized life, where
you
tried morphine, I guess, and other drugs to deal with the pain. Did it get close?
It never essentially touched the pain. When I was awake, I mean, narcotic therapy basically operates on the theory that we can't really stop you having the pain, so we're going to put you to sleep. We're going to anesthetize you so you'll be asleep and not feel it. So no, when I sleep at night, I don't feel the pain. And when I fell asleep at dinner tables on methadone, which I was on for years, then I wasn't feeling the pain very much. But as long as I was wide awake, the pain was basically untouched by the narcotics.
So, did you imagine then a life of unremitting pain?
I imagined it, and I couldn't imagine it. I simply couldn't think how I was going to survive it. And finally, after, as you say, nearly 3 years and two more surgeries after the initial one, I finally phoned my dear friend, my neurosurgeon, one day, and I just said, "Alan, is there absolutely nothing else you could do? I'm going mad." And he said, "Did we ever try biofeedback?"
Had you ever heard of that before?
I'd heard of it, but I had never heard of it as an adjunct to pain control. And I said, "No, why?" And he said, "Well, let's try a little biofeedback." So I went off to the building in which the Duke University Pain Clinic was located, the pain clinic which had only given me narcotics and other forms of sedative drugs. And I moved about 100 yards away from the pain clinic, and with a matter of a couple of weeks, I had discovered through biofeedback, with fairly simple mental disciplines, I had discovered how to selectively relax extremely tense muscles in my neck and back and along my spinal cord, and I received some very slight alleviation of pain from that. And the people in biofeedback said, "Gosh, you're pretty good at this concentration. How about," said, "have you ever tried hypnosis?" And I said, "No, what's that?" And they said, "Well, go to the basement, to the psychiatry department." And
next
sure
to the
enough,
boiler room, right?
Next to the boiler room, right under the pain, right under the famous pain clinic, the pharmaceutical pain clinic, I found this wonderful psychologist who, over a period literally of 6 weeks, 1 hour a week, taught me how to put myself in a state of deep relaxation, which is synonymous basically with a hypnotic state, and to not stop the pain or end the pain or really even diminish the quantity of the pain. But what he taught me how to do was how to ignore it, how simply to say, this does not matter. I'm going about my life.
You write, feel it as real, but not suffer from it.
Exactly. It's as though I used to have a huge bonfire burning in the center of my life. Now I have a huge bonfire burning over at the edge of the room, and I know the bonfire can't spread to me anymore. And I only feel it when you ask me if I'm in pain. Or it's like, you know, people say, don't think of the word hippopotamus right. in the next 30 seconds.
Well, I have a couple more questions for you, if you can stand it.
Surely.
But it's interesting that the biofeedback, I guess, helped you control or at least understand and maybe even rediscover your body.
Absolutely.
And the hypnosis helped you deal with your mind.
Well, I mean, you know, any human being of normal abilities can go into a biofeedback lab in a matter of a few days, for instance, learn how to raise the temperature in your right hand about 12 degrees higher than the temperature in your left hand simply by thinking about it. And these are tricks that we had only seen, you know, Indian yogis do through the years. And so you immediately begin to realize that pain is a function of your brain. As my hypnotist said and built into the hypnotic monologue that I go through when I self-hypnotize, he said, the mind controls the body. All that is perceived in the body is perceived in the mind and nowhere else.
When you're under that kind of constant pain, though, does someone like you, a writer who needs to be creative, get caught up in self-absorption, that the pain focuses too much on self?
Oh, for the first 2 or 3 years of the ordeal, yes. I mean, I did finally, after this five months of depression, get back to work. But the pain, if I look back at the little daily calendars that I kept, the little vest pocket calendars, I see that I simply talk about nothing but pain. I just, you know, I'm measuring it. I'm saying it's a 9 today. It's a 12. They would always say, what's yours on a pain of 1 to a scale of 1 to 10? And I'd say, today it's about a 12. And I was as absorbed and obsessed by my pain as any junkie is by his drug.
It's interesting, though, since 1984, you have written, what, 13 books?
I think it's 13.
Something like 13. Do you feel in a race against time? I mean, that's a lot of writing in the last 10 years.
Yeah. I've never have, you know, seen the Grim Reaper chasing me down with a big sickle. Maybe there's been an element of that in my unconscious mind's motives for giving it to me at a much more rapid rate than it ever did before. But it has never for a moment to me felt like a hysterical or even a hectic race. I've just done it because it was a joy to do and because I got up every morning and went to the computer and it was there waiting to be siphoned off.
Does hypnosis help you to write, help you to unlock memories?
I think it's helped me tremendously in unlocking memory. I've always had a very good and very accessible memory. And the memories that I've recovered, I must say, have not been the kind of stunning, shocking horror memories that so many people in our culture now, I think on a very questionable basis, are recovering. But I would simply remember the wonderful afternoon when Aunt Ida made me such and such a kind of dessert. And I would say, oh, of course, I remember brown sugar sandwiches. But immediately after having the hypnosis, the next two books that I wrote were a novel called The Tongues of Angels and a memoir of my childhood called Clear Pictures. And both those books were largely delivered to me by my unconscious mind. I think when it sort of got the idea. It says, oh, you want memory? Sure, here it is. It wheeled out the drawers and there all the stuff was.
Reynolds Price's new book is a memoir called A Whole New Life. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Reynolds Price talking about his life after a diagnosis of cancer of the spine. Let me ask you about how your perspective has changed from a wheelchair. And it seems at that level, you're kind of at the belly button level.
You're at the belly button, the fanny level, as I like to say.
The fanny level.
If you go to a cocktail party, you're basically in the world of fannies. And some fannies are nicer than others, believe you me. But so I tend to lurk on the edges of parties. But, the world is most definitely not built with wheelchairs in mind. And even now in America, more than 2 years after the passage of the Act for Disabled Americans. Mm. They are the most hilariously horrible barricades. I went this morning for an interview in a hotel in New York, a perfectly self-respecting hotel, and I had to negotiate about 17 steps to get in and out of this hotel.
That make you mad?
It didn't make me mad. It just made me think, what would it take to make the human race realize that there are people in it who are not, absolutely robust? A man whom I admire very much, Chuck Close, the great American painter. Chuck had a spinal hemorrhage a few years ago and is quadriplegic. And Chuck and I were sitting at a meeting of the American Academy of Arts and Letters last spring watching a cocktail party in progress just beyond us. And Chuck said, you know what I call those people? And I said, no. And he said, the temporarily abled.
Is it, though, a problem being at that level that people have to lean down to talk to you? Or how do you want them to do it?
The interesting thing is very few people lean. You really want them to lean. You actually want them to hunker down and talk to you eye to eye. But they almost never do. I suppose they think that would be condescending or else their knees don't work.
Right.
But children are marvelous. It's wonderful to talk to children because they love the fact that here's a grown-up at their eye level. Mm-hmm. Children always come running up to me at the mall, and they don't know why they've run up. And they get there, and they're a little flummoxed. And they say, why don't your legs work? And I say, because I've had cancer, and they're paralyzed. And they say, why are you in that chair? But the nice thing is that children think, oh, here's an old geezer who's as tall as me. So children have got it right. But grown-ups are pretty unsure about how to deal with you. Though I must say I've had very little rejection. I've heard paraplegics, or gimps as I like to call us, say that they've had really humiliating experiences. I must say I've never had one.
Why do you call yourself a gimp?
What else am I going to call myself? I call myself a cripple or a gimp, because I hate those euphemisms, you know, mm-hmm. like the sadly disadvantaged or whatever, all those awful words that social agencies invent for us now, the politically correct. I'm just a person whose legs are gimped, or you can call me paralyzed if you like, or paraplegic, or permanently disabled.
I want to read something from near the end of your book, and you write, the kindest thing anyone could have done for me once I'd finished 5 weeks radiation would have been to look me square in the eye and say this clearly. Reynolds Price is dead. Who will you be now? Who can you be? And how can you get there double time? You feel like you died and came back?
I know I did. Yeah, and I'm still Reynolds Price, but I'm Reynolds Price the second. Revised edition.
How different from the first?
Physically recognizable to people who've known me through my life. Psychically, a much more serene and tolerant human being. In terms of my hands, which give me my work, a writer who writes at about 2 to 3 times the rate that he was ever able to write at before.
But I mean, it's almost a cliche to think that illness makes somebody different or even better.
It's awful to find out that we profit by suffering, isn't it? But the Greeks knew it. So did everybody else in the human race who ever, you know, looked at anything with even a half a degree of reality.
But if 5 weeks into your recovery and diagnosis someone had said that to you, would it have made any sense?
I do think it would. Yes, I think it would have. I mean, after all, I was a fairly highly educated person. I knew that what trauma was. I had heard about disaster. I'd even witnessed it in some dear friends and kinsmen of mine. I think if someone had just said, Reynolds, forget trying to go back and live in that bedroom, ride in that car, wear those clothes, eat that food, live that kind of social schedule, that person's dead. I think, at least on a physical basis, I could have begun to believe them. I think the psychic changes inevitably had to wait until I had some sense that I was no longer streaking down this awful luge run of cancer death and paralysis. Once I began to feel that at least I had stabilized, however temporarily, then I could begin to get my mind on to being the next Reynolds Price as well.
I wonder, too, about the paraplegia and being in a wheelchair, how that's made you different. And you say that you're more patient and watchful.
I'm much more patient and watchful. I think I was always a watchful person, but I'm preternaturally watchful now. I feel I'm some kind of spy in the sky, spy on the ground satellite. Because I just have to sit there. I'm not going anywhere unless someone comes and gets me or unless I can roll myself across the terrain. And believe me, there's one awful lot of terrain in America that one can't roll oneself across.
But when you're in a wheelchair, are you more invisible so you can be more watchful?
Well, we're told that people in wheelchairs are highly obvious and that they offend a number of other people's sensibilities. As I said again, I've never had any sense that I offended anyone. If they did, they were kind enough to conceal the fact from me. I think it's not so much that we're invisible. I do think people find it easier to ignore us because they're embarrassed with not knowing what the politically correct way to approach us would be. I was very touched the other night in a hotel in New York. I was simply pressing up on the arms of my chair to give my fanny a little drink of blood, which it needs to avoid having pressure sores, the bane of paraplegics and quadriplegics. And while I was propped up on my arms in my chair, a very nice woman just came up and said, do you need some help? And I could say, thank you, no. But most people would have run the hell out of the way because they would have thought, what's this gimp doing? Oh, my God, he's what's he doing? And she just did the perfect thing. So if anyone who's temporarily able encounters a person in that situation, I would say, walk up and do what that wonderful woman did. Say, may I help you? Do you need some help?
Now, where or how is the cancer today? And are you cancer-free?
Well, since 1986, when the third surgery and the last surgery to date was performed, no cancer has appeared on the annual MRI scan, which I take. Mm-hmm. So what we say is there is no visible sign of return. And what I say is that I am in cancer recovery as of this instant.
Well, I thank you very much, Reynolds Price, for talking with us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Reynolds Price's book is called A Whole New Life. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.